The Other Side podcast mission is to discuss important cultural and social issues relating to race, culture, gender, and equality.
Hello, welcome to The Other Side podcast. I'm Scott Kirk. And as we mark the one-year anniversary of the killing of George Floyd and the protests that erupted around Ohio and the nation in response, we wanted to talk with reporters and editors from around the state to reflect on what happened, what's changed, and where things are headed next. Joining me are Mark Ferencheck, the Columbus Neighborhoods and Urban Issues reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Kelly Beyer, reporter at the Canton Repository, Kevin Aldridge, opinion editor at the Cincinnati Inquirer, Madeline Mitchell, the education reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Brianna Rice, the breaking news reporter, also at the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Seyma Byram, a corps member with the Report for America, who's reporting for the Akron Beacon Journal. George Floyd, a Black man who died in Minneapolis police custody May 25th, 2020, after a video shared online from a bystander showed a now convicted white officer kneeling on Floyd's neck during his arrest as Floyd pleaded for his life. The video sparked international outrage and some of the largest and most widespread protests the country has ever seen. Welcome to you all. I'm so excited to have you all together. We have a fantastic panel. Let's just get started. We'll start with Akron. And if you could describe for us what the summer protests were like in Akron and what was the reaction from the community?
Yeah, thank you. So I arrived in Akron on June 1st. So I missed part of like the earlier waves of the protests, and I sort of arrived as things were unfolding, and I moved here from Mississippi, and so I had to learn all the different players on the ground, all the different organizers. My beat, as you mentioned, is covering Akron's Black and minority communities, and so for me, the protests became a gateway into understanding the issues that Akron's Black residents cared about, issues around policing, around employment discrimination, housing insecurity, gun violence. There are a lot of unsolved murders here in Akron. Nationwide, murders involving Black victims tend to have much lower solve rates, and that's the case here in Akron as well. And so you know, sort of twofold. It was on the one hand, I was trying to cover these, you know, daily protests, but also trying to get into, go a little bit deeper into the reasons, motivations for why people were out there. And, you know, when you're covering protests, I'm sure everybody here can agree with this. You know, sometimes you also run into, you know, conflicts among organizers, or you've got differing agendas, and, you know, and you start to see, you know, who's really been on the ground doing work in Akron or in another city, and what might be some of the other motivations for some of the other protests. And so that was interesting to kind of parse out.
If you could, along the same lines, just kind of give us a feel for what it was like in Cincinnati on the ground during that summer when the protests were happening.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start. So I was working breaking news at the time, and I remember that first day of the protests, we had no idea what was going to be happening. We didn't know how big it was going to be. And when I originally showed up, I want to say there was just a couple dozen people there, like maybe 20 people that were there outside of the courthouse. I met up with Brianna a little bit later, and it was just crazy to see how it grew that first night. I mean, by the end of the night, there were thousands of people on the streets, and I ended up counting, you know, people by blocks worth, because you couldn't really gauge how many people there were anymore. I would stand in one spot and just watch as they marched and be like, okay, that was about three or four blocks worth of people that have joined at this point. And it was also interesting, you know, the first 5 hours or so of that initial rally was incredibly peaceful. You know, people were just marching, chanting. And then there was a turning point at around like 11:30 that night, when it got closer to midnight. And that's when things got a little bit more chaotic. People were throwing bricks into the Justice Center and lighting the American flag on fire. And I think Brianna and I both kind of saw that moment at the same time, like, oh, this is different now. And even noticing that these are different groups of people that were coming in, it wasn't faces that we had recognized from the rest of the day. And in the days that followed, there were certain characters that, you know, we recognized and could go back to. One of the main organizers, Jordan Telting, was there every day that I was there also and saw him. But definitely, like we were saying before, you know, conflicts among different groups that were trying to organize these protests. And, you know, there's always some confusion, I think, at the end of the day. How do we end? Did we accomplish what we wanted to accomplish today? What was the goal? The fizzling out each day was very interesting to me, you know, when people decided to go home.
Yeah. So what I'll say is I also just, that first day, you know, again, there were a lot of marchings. At one point, people, you know, shut down the highway. There were all of these just very big moments, I would say. And just, you know, people got really upset at people who were still dining in OTR, even though, even as reporters, we didn't know it was going to be that big, right? Like, we went and we covered pretty much every protest we hear about, you know. We assumed, what, 2 hours, like, every protest, and it just kept growing. We didn't know what was happening, so felt very grateful, you know, to have Maddie there with me too, because it also was the first and the only time I've really seen a police presence like that in Cincinnati, where it was just like all at once, as soon as the, and they weren't there at first really until someone threw a brick into the Justice Center, you know, but then there was a huge police presence. And then after that, I think the police presence kind of stayed around, but they really, in my experience, kind of kept their distance as much as possible and tried to let people, unless things got, you know, too, if it got violent. Yeah. So most of the time, though, it was interesting to see how people were protesting. I think, like, in the days that followed, sometimes there were a lot more speakers or performances or gatherings. And sometimes it was just a lot of marching and not as much speaking, or who was taking up space there. I think with George Floyd, something I saw a lot of the time, it was people of color who were leading it, which was interesting, you know, and people who were, you know, I think I saw a lot of white people just stepping down, even if they typically would have been the people trying to organize this in this space. They're like, let's give the space to people of color, which I think was different. Even with Black Lives Matter protests that I've seen in years past, I think I saw more of that. So, yeah.
Kevin, what about you?
Yeah, you know, Brianna and Madeline, they were, you know, more sort of on the ground. So I'll speak from the perspective of somebody who was gathering just, you know, perspectives from out, you know, from around the community at that time. And the interesting thing for me was to try to see different groups and organizations try to find out where they fit in into the protest, whether that was the religious community, whether that was how older people in leadership were trying to, you know, marry their tactics and their ideas with what younger protesters were doing. I think there was some feeling that this was perhaps a younger movement. And I think some of the older leaders in the city wanted to kind of try to see, you know, how the younger faction of Cincinnati was going to lead this while being a guiding force, but not sort of overstepping kind of the momentum and the passion that the younger Cincinnatians were taking up. So just watching that dynamic come together and literally how people were trying to find out, not to mention, as they talked about, how allies of African-Americans wanted to see how they fit in. So it was just interesting to see all of these different groups and constituencies try to gel and, you know, put forth a singular message at this time. And that was sort of one of the bigger takeaways for me, was just to see how this puzzle was going to come together around this issue.
Kelly, what about you?
Like some other people mentioned, the protesting Canton actually started on May 29th. And that first day, you know, we weren't really sure what to expect either. I was the reporter sent to cover that on that first night. And it just grew to, I think, a lot larger crowd than we had expected. It was unclear sort of who had actually organized it. I think the initial, like, person who had posted on social media ended up not really taking the lead. And it just kind of became a spontaneous march through downtown Canton. So as the night went on, you know, it was pretty much peaceful throughout. At the end, unfortunately, because of our deadlines, I had just left when sort of the police and protesters clashed. And that kind of sparked a lot of the continuation of protests throughout the summer, because they had used tear gas and their MRAP armored vehicle and had been rather aggressive, according to a lot of the protesters we spoke with. Of course, from the police perspective, they said they were having items thrown at them. But that kind of became what led to a lot of groups forming throughout the summer. A lot of them evolved, as you had heard before, as well at other places. Some of the leaders sort of fell out with others and formed different groups. So there were a number of groups that met with city officials throughout the year. Those meetings sort of fell by the wayside or didn't really result in much, I guess, progress, as some of the protesters would say. But there have been a number of meetings that have continued between the NAACP and local ministers. Throughout the summer, we covered protests sort of on and off. Unfortunately for me, it was the day after May 29th was the start of our furloughs. So it was kind of frustrating to not be able to continue to follow the protests and have that consistency. But you know, our reporters went out, I think, at a lot of the highlights and tried to capture as well as we could throughout the summer. Kind of just continued on throughout the year with a mix of community meetings and protests that, you know, pretty much just blocked the roadways. And that, as it continued, I think there was some community frustration about that, but there was a good mix of, I think, support and just sort of, I guess, collaboration throughout the year.
Mark, why don't you tell us what it was like in Columbus?
Well, again, the protests started here on the night of the 28th, which was a Thursday night, but they really ramped up the night of Friday, May 29th, then into the day on Saturday and Saturday night. Major confrontations between police downtown and protesters. And there, again, there were hundreds of protesters. It was something that I don't think any of us had ever seen just in terms of volume. And at least to me, one thing that struck me was this was all kind of brand new to everybody, and everybody's trying to figure out how this was going to work, because it obviously it started as a peaceful protest, but then there were many confrontations between police who were, again, wearing body vests, helmets, using lots of tear gas and pepper spray. I got pepper sprayed off the sidewalk, even though I was just standing there with other people, and they got pepper sprayed because they were trying to move people back. Tear gas canisters were being, you know, shot at the lines of protesters and on Broad Street, and they were throwing the tear gas canisters back at police. It reminded me of something you would see from films from the 1960s or 1970s during anti-war demonstrations or civil rights demonstrations. So there was a lot of damage downtown Friday night and Saturday night. Lots of places had windows smashed. Some of them were looted, but not all of them. But there was just a lot of anger. And I don't know if you remember that on Saturday, U.S. Representative Joyce Beatty and Kevin Boyce, who's a county commissioner here in Franklin County, and the city council president, Shannon Hardin, were all pepper sprayed and by police. And to say the least, that started even more conversation about the tactics the police were using. And it led to a lot of discussion that we're still having today about police reform and what police should and shouldn't do. And again, back on April 30th, there was a decision by a federal judge here in Columbus, Algernon Marbley, granted a preliminary injunction against Columbus Division of Police barring officers' use of tear gas, pepper spray, wooden bullets, and other so-called non-lethal force against non-violent protesters. And that decision was made after 26 protesters filed suit that said they were brutalized by police during the demonstrations last year. After that first weekend, there were still many demonstrations downtown, going up into the university area as well. But what it really started was a community conversation, like in a lot of communities across the country, beyond police, about income inequality, about how police respond to situations in various neighborhoods, what's the best way to deal with certain situations, and again, turning more attention on police shootings here in Columbus, where people have died, most recently Micaiah Bryant, or injured, and how policing, again, there seems to be a large rate of police shootings here in Columbus, and concerns about that, and how to deal with it. So these discussions have continued on throughout the year, and they will continue to go on because of what's happening here and across the country.
This question is open to anyone. As a journalist, we're also human beings. And so how, in that moment, initially, when the protests started, how did you process that on a journalistic level, but also how did you process it on a humanistic, just anyone who feels comfortable opening up?
I'll say, so I remember in college, one of my professors said to me, there are two people who run towards fires. It's like police officers and journalists. And I definitely feel that energy. Like, you know, as all of this is happening around you, you just feel like you want to be there. It's the only thing you can do. You know, we're not allowed to protest. We're not allowed to like publicly say anything. So, and I know Kelly mentioned this, but like furloughs are coming up too. So like they're... It's this feeling like I need to be here. I remember in the days coming after, they actually told Maddie and I we couldn't cover all of the protests. And I remember being so upset. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? Like, we want to be there. We need to be there. Like, we want to tell this story. And just being so aware of language at that time, just like saying, you know, not just that George Floyd was killed or like George Floyd died in police custody, but like he died by someone putting their knee on his neck for, you know, 8 minutes. Like, that language matters to people. And so I was just... You know, I'm 24, so I'm just celebrating my 2 years at the Inquirer, 3 years of full-time reporting. So it's, I felt like this is all very new to me, you know, and I could definitely, it, I know it feels significant to everyone now, but at the time I'm like, wow, I mean, I've never seen it. Like, have other people seen something like this? You know, it felt very important to be there and just be aware of the language and just seeing all the different types of people, you know, coming together over this. And yeah, I think a lot of people also just, I'm all over the place right now, but even just being scared a little bit too when the officers are like throwing pepper spray. Like, we didn't expect that to happen. Like, once people started throwing bricks, just also being there in that moment, I think some of the protesters who weren't involved, everyone is like, what is happening now? Like, this feels a little different. And just seeing all these officers coming out with their big shields and pushing the crowd back and then spraying, like, to this day, I don't know if it was pepper spray. I'm not an expert on sprays. Like, I feel like as a journalist, we can't even say it was pepper spray. We're like, what? We're being sprayed with something. Like, we're not sure what it is. It definitely burns, but just being unsure in that moment and scared and just like, there was a lot going on, windows breaking and just really trying to make sure in that moment, all we can do is get on Facebook Live and tell people what's happening and say what we know, which isn't even much because it's all over the city and we're in this one space, but just trying to be everywhere at once. That's what I remember.
Thanks for sharing, Brianna. Anybody else?
I'll just speak from, I'm one who's pretty much out front as a journalist to say that, you know, we're human beings. And to pretend that any of us did not have some sort of opinion or emotional reaction to what's going on is just not being honest and upfront. So I think there's a difference between having an opinion and an emotional reaction and being professional. Our charge as journalists is we still have to go out and do our job professionally and try to tell all aspects of a story. And so to deny the fact that, you know, we were feeling a certain way in an effort to try to appear unbiased to the public, I think is just being false. You know, I'm pretty transparent. You know, as an African-American man, seeing what happened to George Floyd stirred up all sorts of things inside of me. And, you know, I have the latitude as a columnist, as an opinion editor, to sort of express my opinions, you know, in a way that Brianna and Madeline do not as a reporter. But I still have an obligation to do that responsibly, you know, to do it factually. And so what I tried to do was encapsulate all of those things that I felt as an African-American male looking at that video and the subsequent protests, to try to help explain to readers who might not be coming from that perspective why you're seeing what you're seeing and what are some of the emotions that are going on inside of folks. Now, certainly, I don't speak for all Black people or for all Black men, but I think there is some general commonality in terms of what many of us were feeling as we saw that. And I think to help shape the dialogue, to help people understand what they're seeing, because a lot of people look at protests and some of the things that are going on out there, and they have no concept or can't understand why people are responding in the way that they are, because it's just not their reality. It's just not their perspective. And so I think what I saw as my role was, as best I could, is to try to say, here is someone that someone might look at and I say this, you know, I say this with humility, not with any kind of arrogance, but, you know, people look at me as someone who is a sort of a respectable member of sort of the working media establishment. Sometimes, you know, I don't get looked at as similarly as some of the Black people who are out there in the protests, but I don't feel any differently than a lot of those folks. And so maybe they'll take it a little bit better hearing it from me than maybe they would, you know, from a protester who, you know, in the heat of the moment or the passion, can't string words together in a way that, you know, people can read it and digest it. So I sort of saw that as my role in to say, how do we take the emotion of this moment and put it together in a way where we can kind of really explain to people who just don't get it or don't understand it, you know, what Black people are feeling in this moment.
I'm going to say this is Mark. I think what it also shows across the country, because of what happened in terms of the number of protests, not only here in Ohio, but across the country, the number of people involved in the protest and the anger about what happened in Minneapolis, it shows in a lot of ways, it's protests work. They drove the conversation. You know, if the protest would not have happened, a lot of these conversations that we're having right now today, a year later, and throughout the course of the year, might not have happened. But because so many people got together, and a lot of it obviously was through social media, which was different than in past years, where people were able to mobilize very quickly, and lots of diverse communities were able to get together to protest, the protests make a difference. And certainly our reporting of that and opinion columns after that certainly propelled the conversations to this day. But again, just the sheer number of people who protested across the country had a huge, huge, huge impact. Most of, you know, not most of them, many of them younger, from all sorts of different backgrounds. And that really, really made a difference.
If I could also add, really just building off of the earlier remarks. So for me, I was living in Mississippi, and I drove to Ohio. That's how I moved. And so I stopped in Nashville and in Louisville. And, you know, I wasn't yet working, but I used social media to document some of the conversations I had with, you know, protesters. I interviewed the family of David McAtee, who had just been shot in Louisville by Louisville police. And so for me, it was like, it was very much like Brianna said, you know, feeling this journalistic duty to document what was going on around me. I think I also, because I was following coverage across the country of these protests before I arrived in Akron, I was really disappointed in some of the language that you saw big name publications use. I remember the New York Times, you know, they use the passive voice when referring to a photographer who had just been shot by police, right? And she was blinded. But then whenever there were any mentions of protesters, it was in the active voice and, you know, protesters did these bad things. And so I saw it as an opportunity to shift that narrative and to try to really show readers, you know, why are people upset, right? And I just also think, you know, this obsession with objectivity. I mean, I think objectivity is a myth. And I think you can be fair and you can be really, you know, robust in your reporting. But I think objectivity is a myth. And I think our obsession, you know, even after like watching, this video of this man being killed by a police officer, the fact that we're still talking about objectivity, to me, I think it's a symptom of the fact that the majority of, you know, US newsrooms are still staffed by people who have either never faced or experienced systemic oppression or don't realize that they have. And so I think, you know, I think some things are just wrong. And, you know, in the same way that, you know, we think about like climate change and how the discourse on climate change was very much, you know, both sides isms, right? Like throughout the 90s. And how, you know, you hear people now talking about the harms that caused when we give platforms to people who are spreading misinformation about what's happening to the environment and how that may have delayed some of the urgent action we could have taken. I sort of see this in a similar way. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm Kurdish. You know, I'm a former refugee, so I'm used to seeing people fight for their rights. And I think, you know, I think if we look at a lot of the U.S., I mean, a lot of like American coverage of Black and minority communities, there have just been a lot of, a lot of harms done. You know, the way we use the term terrorist, for example, like all these different, you know, I mean, anyway, I can go on and on, but yeah.
But that is the perfect segue to my next question, because I want to talk a little bit about the newsrooms and how our respective newsrooms responded. Do you all feel that this produced significant change in the newsroom in terms of how communities of color are covered? Simple things such as how, when to use mugshots. Talk a little bit about the changes you've seen in your newsrooms, if any, and how the communities of color in your cities are being covered? Has the coverage changed? Is the way it's being covered changed? And that's open to anybody.
So I'll say in Cincinnati, and Brianna can jump in on this too, because she's been a part of some of the changes that have been initiated at the Enquirer. But I will say that even before the George Floyd incident, I think there were some things that we were doing in our newsroom, that there was a recognition that some of the ways that we were going about covering not just African-American communities, but all different types of communities, that we weren't as sharp as we needed to be in terms of how we were presenting communities, how we were including them in just average everyday stories, that we're not about trying to pander to any communities by just going out and doing surface stories, but we want to actually make sure that we're covering diverse communities as part of what we do every day. And so to that end, we have done some things in Cincinnati. So, for example, I lead a social justice team that we formulated in the wake of George Floyd. And this team is specifically, both Brianna and Madeline are a part of that team. And part of our goal is to make sure every month, you know, we do audits of the paper to look at, you know, how are people of color showing up, and are we hitting our benchmarks, and how are we using language and photos? What do a cut lines on photos even look like? And so Brianna led an initiative in the newsroom that dealt with police mugshots, and we got those situations changed, and she can talk a little bit more about that. So there has been a recognition in Cincinnati that we need to do more. We have monthly trainings where we invite in different people from the community, from different diverse backgrounds. We had someone from the transgender community present last month. We have someone from the Jewish community coming in fact, tomorrow for a training session in the wake of everything that we saw going on in the Middle East recently. So we're always trying to train our staff to help us understand better and getting feedback from the community about how we're showing up, what we're doing right, what we're not doing right. And so I'll end there and let Brianna and Madeline talk more about, you know, their involvement in some of the things that they're doing.
Well, I mean, Brianna did a lot of work with the mugshots. I would say, you know, these trainings are so important. And also just, you know, giving people a space to talk and let us know what language is hurtful to these communities, because sometimes we don't know. And also that language changes all of the time. What was acceptable to say even just 20 years ago is maybe not acceptable to say anymore in certain communities. And so getting that update and just knowing, you know, we have such a great responsibility with how we write stories and what language we use, and knowing, you know, that little word that you didn't think twice about has a severe impact on those communities. I think that's really important. And also, you know, there was around this time, just a couple of weeks after these protests began, there was a Black trans woman in near Cincinnati who was killed, Raya Milton, and she was misgendered by the police and by the media. And that was extremely hurtful to that community. And I had initially covered when it first happened, and I ended up forming a relationship with her sister, who is also a Black trans woman. And I felt that it was extremely important to keep that relationship with her and then later come out with a piece that was about her sister and showing an alive, thriving Black trans person and their experience, so that not all of our coverage is about death in those communities.
Kelly, what about you?
Yeah, as far as Canton, I don't know if I can point to any examples of our reporting that's actually changed, but I know a lot of, so we were a Gatehouse paper before we merged with Gannett, but a lot of, you know, the changes in the past year, I think that are for, you know, Gannett-wide with the crime policy that we've started to implement and, you know, really looking at more of a case-by-case basis of, is this serving the community if we report this as just a, you know, one-off, or are we actually going to follow it through and see what happens? I think we've done away with the mugshots as well. And a lot of the changes in the past year just with, you know, style and really examining it more, I think, is something that we hadn't done in the past, as far as just at least having the conversations and trying to be, you know, more aware about, you know, what the power.
Kelly, let me ask you, though. What was it about? Why now? What was it about this particular event that caused those changes? Why wasn't it 5 years ago or 10 years ago, do you think? What is it specifically about this time that brought about these changes?
I have the same question because I was here when, you know, I guess the Black Lives Matter protests of 2015 or so happened. And there were a few small demonstrations, but nothing at the level it is now. It just seems like we've reached a point where I guess there's sort of a nationwide awakening to what's happening, or maybe people have just, you know, generations have changed and people have now said, you know, enough is enough. I'm not really sure. But I think a lot of the changes for our newsroom are coming from, you know, the corporate level. But as far as this movement itself, it just seems to, like you said, have a lot more sustaining power than some in the past. And I don't know why that is.
Mark, I know that there's, just talk a little bit about what's been going on at the Dispatch. There's definitely been some movement in terms of diversifying the staff. There's been a lot of conversation about style and just policies in terms of coverage of communities.
So you might remember back in September, Marianne Renaud, who is a terrific young reporter who lives in New York now, but she used to work for us. And she did a story for the Columbia Journalism Review titled, it's basically about us. And the title, the headline was Ohio's Whitest Home Newspaper. And the concern that the Dispatch has never, the newsroom has never looked like the community covers. Certainly going back to the days of John Wolfe, when it was a locally owned paper, when John was one of the titans in the community, in a lot of ways calling, you know, shots here. And, you know, the her article and you know, basically re-encapsulated what a lot of people have already been concerned about here, was that the Dispatch, a lot of people felt that the Dispatch never covered the communities of color here in Columbus, either equitably or often. And they, again, a lot of people never even read the newspaper because they didn't think there was anything in the Dispatch for them. So I know that we've made efforts to try to diversify our staff, kind of late in the game, obviously. But again, the city's population is very diversified. We have a huge and a growing refugee and immigrant population here. The Black population is about a quarter to a third of the total population of the city. And I'm an urban issues and neighborhood reporter. But I also know that we have a lot of blind spots in terms of how we cover various communities and just the amount of coverage that we give, whether it's feature stories, in-depth stories. I know when Rita Price and I did a lot of stories on income inequality, that opened a lot of eyes here because, again, Columbus is always perceived to be the shining city in Ohio because it's continuously growing and continues to lure people here. But we have a lot of people who are struggling here and a lot of people working some, you know, lots of low-wage jobs. So we have to continue to do that well, but then we also have to continue to diversify our newsroom, getting it younger, and so we can have people to give voice to people in the community that we haven't done that well with in the past.
Saima, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think we're having similar conversations. You know, one of the conversations we're having is when we cover communities of color, there tends to be an emphasis on pathologies, right? You know, how can we just cover people as they are and show positive stories? Also, another conversation we're having is just making sure that our sourcing is diverse. You know, a story does not have to be about race in order for you to talk to a Black person to get their perspective. And so those kinds of conversations, I would say. And I think, you know, I think that, how should I put this? I think diversity is really, really important, both in terms of bringing in like newer voices, younger voices, but also, you know, we know that this field historically has experienced Black journalists and editors, right? And experienced reporters of color are also important. And so one thing, you know, I think a lot about is, you know, whether like the approach to diversity when we're thinking about like diverse hiring, because you do hear, you know, you do hear of situations where you might bring in a reporter of color, but if like all leadership at an organization is white, you know, then like what kinds of stories are told, right? And what kinds of stories don't get told. So I think, you know, that's something, you know, I talk a lot about with colleagues at different newsrooms and stuff. And so anyway, so that's sort of my, you know, my thoughts on diversity and some of the conversations I've had.
I wanted to add just one thing on diversity too that I found interesting. It's just like, we could totally match the demographics of a city, especially in a place like Ohio. Yeah, the cities are going to be Black, but like some of the smaller places, you could match the demographics. And that is awesome. We want to do that. But also just bring in other people. Like maybe we don't have a huge Asian American population in Cincinnati, but still bringing in an Asian American person would bring a diverse perspective that we might, that our newsroom's just going to be richer for having. So I don't think like doing the diversity thing of matching whatever the census says is probably the best strategy, but like we just want different people from everywhere to bring in something cool. And I know that we've already touched on objectivity, but like who does that serve anyway? Just the idea of it and how we've like manifested it in our newsrooms. I think I've been really after these protests just thinking about who that serves and why it's that way, because obviously objectivity is a weird thing. But I'm gonna, yeah, those are all my thoughts.
How did the George Floyd murder and in the protest, has it changed how you report on stories or as a columnist, how you write your columns? And if so, in what way?
So I'm going to answer this kind of in conjunction with a question you asked earlier about just, you know, like how we were able to deal with those emotions while we were covering these protests. Mm-hmm. So a couple weeks ago, during the Chauvin trial, when they read out loud that he was convicted, I was overwhelmed emotionally.
Emotionally overwhelmed? Mm-hmm.
Completely emotionally overwhelmed when that was read. And I think it was because when we were covering those protests, I was in a work zone, a work mode. And I, you know, we were walking with these protesters for 11, 12 hours during the day, and you're exhausted and you're sweaty and it's hot and you're just trying to get these quotes. And it was exhausting, you know, in those moments. And I couldn't even process weeks, months afterwards, I couldn't even process what that moment meant for Cincinnati, for the country, and even for me on a personal level. And so just a few weeks ago when that was read and when he was convicted, it has changed me as a journalist and as a person, because I realized that I have to be more balanced and be able to take a step back and kind of remove myself from those moments sometimes so that I can process as a human being. Because I'm a much better writer when I do that. And when I take time for myself and, you know, allow myself to collect my thoughts about the issues that I'm writing on. And we've talked about objectivity and like, obviously, you know, I have my own opinions. But if I can take time to do that first and then go out and talk to people in the community and write for them, I think I'm doing a much better job serving Cincinnati that way.
Anybody else?
So I'll just add, as a reporter, I think how it changed my reporting bit, as you know before, and as you're taught in journalism school, like police are official sources, you know, what they say is good to go on. And I think looking at the initial press release that came out from George Floyd's death, and, you know, I don't think I was naive enough to believe police told the truth all the time before. You know, Canton has had its own sort of incidents of police brutality, but, you know, I think I now hold their word with about the same weight as I would, you know, anyone else. I think that's the biggest thing for me.
I totally agree with this. If again, this is all of, much of this has been a good learning experience, and also to reteach everybody in the profession that, again, it's just old-fashioned shoe leather reporting. You have to go out into communities and talk to people, not nonprofits, not officials, not, you know, go-to people. We always go to universities or so-called experts, but you have to go and talk to people to see what's going on. And there's a lot going on that has been underreported in terms of just people's day-to-day experiences.
And again, our staffs are short. You know, we don't have anything like the size of the staffs we used to have, and that's unfortunate. And that's just the nature of the business right now. But we have to spend the time to get into communities and talk to people who usually don't talk to us and might have some concerns about talking to us. But if we can develop relationships with folks, get them to trust us, we can tell very rich, detailed stories that certainly tell what's really going on in our communities rather than relying on people we always go to.
You know, I would just say for myself as a columnist, this has really challenged me to think about how to write differently. You know, because I'll be honest, when all of this first went down, as somebody who's been at this for a long time, 20 plus years doing this, I sort of felt like as I sat down to write my first column, it's like I've said all of this stuff before. It's like I feel like I'm writing and repeating the same things and we're having the same conversation. And it's kind of like beating your head against a brick wall. And I'll be honest, there was a period where I was in a bit of a writing funk where I would just wasn't motivated to write because it felt like I was just writing and it was just falling upon deaf ears, like nobody was listening to it. And I really did feel this point of like, do I even want to do this anymore? Is it even being effective? Is anybody even listening to it? But then I sort of reached a point that said, you know, if we're having the same conversations over and over again, then maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe part of the challenge is how do we figure out how to talk about this differently and to try to approach some of these complex topics in different ways? And so that's kind of the challenge that I've taken on in the wake of this is if I'm going to put, you know, fingers to the keyboard or pen to paper, so to speak, to write about something, is how can I write about it from a different approach and take a look at it from a different angle that just might get people to think about things in a way that they haven't before. And so I think it's actually helped to sharpen my skills as a columnist because I don't fall into sort of the same old, you know, ways of approaching an issue that now I'm really am thinking, you know, okay, how can we really talk about these issues in ways that we haven't talked about before that can try to move the conversation forward and create greater understanding?
Well, I'd like to thank the panel for joining me today. Mark Ferencek, Kelly Beyer, Kevin Aldridge, Madeline Mitchell, Brianna Rice, and Saymon Byram. You all did a fantastic job of helping us understand what happened over the last year and how we move forward. For everyone else out there listening, thanks for tuning in. If you enjoy the content such as this and want to support local journalism, please consider becoming a subscriber to the Columbus Dispatch, the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Akron Beacon Journal, the Canton Repository, or any of the other fine papers in our Ohio network. Until the next time, try to see things from the other side. Thanks.